morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Russia refuses to extend a UN-brokered Ukraine grain deal.
What is really necessary is movement on both sides. We need to find ways of boosting production and making sure there's enough available food within global and regional systems.
Al-Shabaab imposes a blockade on Baidoa town in Somalia. We'll have reactions to Zimbabwe's so-called patriotic law. Civil and human rights defenders in Nigeria call for the immediate release of the suspended Central Bank of Nigeria governor. The only Sierra Leone opposition MP to take the oath of office defends his decision.
I did not break rank. I just followed the required constitutional clause that says every individual being elected as a member of parliament, that person needs to take the oath of office. That's what I did.
And an eyewitness talked about an attack by a gunman that killed 10 people in Cameroon. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Russia is refusing to extend a UN-brokered deal that has allowed Ukraine to export grain and other food items during the conflict in Ukraine to Africa and other places around the world. The so-called Black Sea Grain Initiative was reached a year ago and allowed for international shipments of corn, wheat, barley, and other food items from three ports in Ukraine. Aid groups say the grain deal was a lifeline to the Horn of Africa, and that without it, hundreds of thousands of people face starvation. VOA's Carol Van Dam as Harry Van Hoven, international economist at Columbia University and senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy. What, if anything, the U.S. can do to help African countries?
Unfortunately, our international institutions are not very well set up to think about both either those supply dynamics or those demand dynamics. And, you know, what is really necessary is movement on both sides. We need to find ways of boosting production and making sure there's enough available food within global and regional systems. But also, as I said, on the demand side, making sure that people's purchasing power, even in the face of declining supply, is resilient, is stable. And that's also not happening at this moment in time. So that's why I'm so worried on about the current situation.
What, if anything, can the U.S. do to try to help the situation?
Well, very important, because I said one of the key drivers of food insecurity at this moment for many people is the problem of indebtedness. Many developing countries have seen their debt levels really skyrocket in the last couple of years, on the back, of course, of public health crises like COVID, but also on the back of a number of other decisions, including, of course, rises in U.S. interest rates, which have global repercussions and make it much harder for developing countries to access capital. I understand, of course, that this is a decision of the U.S. Federal Reserve, and that, of course, its first priority is to deal with the U.S. population, the U.S. economy and its needs. But it is very important to keep in mind from a U.S. government standpoint that these have global ripple effects, very destabilizing global ripple effects. And so to the extent that the U.S. is trying to also accomplish a number of goals, for example, in East Africa, for example, across the Arab world, it needs to scale, therefore, other forms of assistance. And most importantly, we need to make progress on issues of global indebtedness, because this, more than anything, is putting pressures, as I said, on currencies and the ability of nations to import and therefore to pay for things they absolutely need as necessities. Think of medication, think of food, think of fertilizer. And unless and until we see concerted action there from the United States, from the European Union, from other wealthy countries, it's going to be very, very difficult to mitigate this crisis.
The Black Sea Grain Initiative enabled nearly 33 million tons of grain and food staples to go from the Black Sea ports, you know, to Africa, other countries too. And it really did bring down food prices. Do you expect the prices for wheat and other grains to start soaring again now in Africa?
Likely. As I said, it's the result of many different factors, not only of what happens, of course, with exports from Ukraine or even exports from Ukraine and Russia. But it is a contributing factor. And given how dire the situation is, we need as many factors as possible to work to the advantage of having food prices decline and fertilizer prices decline. not to put upward pressures on them. In that sense, as I said, yes, I'm afraid that this will reverse some of the gains that we've made in combination with these climatic shifts, in combination with global interest rates going up, and as I said, the outstanding problem of global indebtedness. Those are really the kind of the key pieces of the food insecurity problem, both acute in this very moment as well as kind of more long term.
That was Harry Verhoeven, a senior research scholar at the Center for Global Energy Policy. He was speaking to my colleague Carol Van Dam from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Somalia President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed has condemned the militant group Al-Shabaab for imposing a week-long blockade on the southwestern town of Baidoa. Authorities say the Islamist group has cut off supplies in and out of the area, worsening hunger caused by record drought and insecurity. Ahmed Mohamed reports from Mogadishu.
Al-Shabaab set up the blockade Tuesday, cutting off transport to and from Baidoa, the capital of southwestern state. The blockade, which comes ahead of the planned government military offensive in the region, has affected businesses and resulted in price hikes as vehicles transporting goods from towns such as Mogadishu are stranded. Hussein Mohamud, the chief of staff for Somali's president, said the blockade demonstrates that Al-Shabaab is at war against the people of Somalia. Mohamed Edin, a trader in Baidoa, told VOA businesses will soon be forced to close as supplies dwindled. He says, I rely on supplies from Mogadishu, which passes through Avgoye, but since Al-Shabaab blocked the routes, my business has suffered. He says, my stock is almost depleted and I may be forced to close my business if the blockade continues. According to the UN, Baidoa is currently home to about 600,000 internally displaced people pushed from their homes by the Al-Shabaab insurgency and drought. Analysts say by imposing the blockade, Al-Shabaab is affirming its strength and that could worsen the situation in the region. Abdulrahman Azari is the director of the Mogadishu-based Center for Analysis and Strategic Studies. He says, Al-Shabaab is sending direct and indirect messages to the Somali government, saying they are still in control of parts of the country and can impose sanctions anywhere and people still obey their orders. Azari adds that the blockade could jolt the government into an earlier launch of a planned offensive. The Somali government says it's on course to launch Operation Black Lion, which will focus on southwest and Jubaland states in the southern part of the country. The government forces, with the help of local militias, reclaimed part of the central area of the country from Al-Shabaab control last summer in the first phase of the offensive. Ethiopia, Kenya, and Djibouti are expected to send in about 20,000 troops to bolster Somali forces and clan militia in the second phase of the operation. Abdulaziz Isaac, a security and political analyst at the Hamid bin Khalifa Civilization Center, says Al-Shabaab's blockade is sending a message. He says the blockade by Al-Shabaab on Baidoa demonstrates the group's ability to challenge the government, despite local and international efforts to defeat the group. Al-Shabaab is telling the Somali government that it will face stiff resistance when it begins the second phase. Southwest state Borno remains the most vulnerable region in Somalia in terms of insecurity and drought. In April, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres visited Baidoa to launch a humanitarian campaign for Somalia to stave off famine. Ahmed Mohamed for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
Zimbabwe's opposition parties and non-governmental organizations say the Criminal Law Codification and Reform Amendment Bill, commonly referred to as the Patriotic Bill, which was signed into law by President Emmerson Mnangagwa a few days ago, will violate most freedoms in the country. Prince Dubiko Sibanda, a member of the main opposition Citizens Coalition for Change, led by Nelson Chamisa, tells Gibbs Dube of VOA Zimbabwe Service that the new law is targeted at progressives in Zimbabwe ahead of the August 23rd general elections.
The Criminal Law Codification and Reform Act, Chapter 923 of 2022, seeks to amend Section 22 of the Criminal Law Codification and Reform Act of 2004. The idea of this insertion or an addition or amendment to that act is to make it an offense for anyone to will please speak about speak about things that are seen to be negative about the country. So what it means is that we are all forced to praise, to sing praises to the government of this of the day, and say they are doing extremely well, regardless of the challenges that we are facing as a nation. And then in our view, it then says that if you are found guilty of that offense, then you are as good as the person that has committed treason. You have attempted or you have removed or you have concealed the removal of a constitutionally elected government. And honestly speaking, I think those two things can be equated. What Mnangagwa is basically saying is that don't criticize me. See nothing bad about me. You should continue to see good even when I am pillaging the resources of the country.
Prince Tumiko Sibanda is a member of the Opposition Citizens Coalition for Change, or CCC. He was speaking with Gibbs Dube of Viewers Zimbabwe's service from Bulawayo. Gibbs also spoke with Mlungusi Moyo, a ruling ZANU-PF Central Committee member, who says Zimbabweans should support the new law.
The people that are more concerned about the Patriotic Act, the beneficiaries of the propaganda or the smear campaign before that tainted Zimbabwe. The Patriotic Act is very clear. It does not encroach on people's freedom. It promotes patriotism of all Zimbabweans for Zimbabwe. You will then discover that if we're to go back, these non-governmental organizations are the same organizations that were going to push propaganda about Zimbabwe, so that they can get funding or sponsorship. The same opposition, it's on the record, that the people who clamored for sanctions were the leaders of the main opposition party. But now, because there's an act that makes it illegal for one to engage in such, for lack of a better term, atrocious talking, they are the very first people who then find this opportunity or who then lay into this platform and start going to the ordinary citizens and misrepresenting what the Patriotic Act stands for. The people's freedom as enshrined in the Constitution, they haven't been touched even an iota of that by the Patriotic Act.
That was Mlungisi Moyo, a ZANU-PF Central Committee member, speaking with Gibbs Dube of VOA Zimbabwe Service from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 18. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. VOA's English to Africa service celebrates its 60th anniversary on August 4th. Help us celebrate by sharing your thoughts on our programs. Send a voice message or a text to this WhatsApp number, +1 202 258 3076. Once again, +1 202 258 3076. Tell us what your favorite program is, or let us know about a particular news story that you connected with. Recall a favorite memory about VOA Africa and tell us what stories you think we should cover or how we can improve. Once again, the WhatsApp number is +1 202 258 3076. And we thank you for 60 years of support. In Sierra Leone, the lone opposition member of parliament who joined ruling party MPs to take the oath of office following the June 24 elections says he followed the law. The Electoral Commission said the ruling Sierra Leone People's Party, the SLPP, won a majority of seats, 81, compared to 54 seats for the opposition All People's Congress, APC party. The rest of the APC members did not take their oath because the party says the government tampered with the election results to favor the ruling SLPP. Mohamed Bangura says while he agrees with his party about irregularities in the election results, he wants APC legislators to come to parliament and do the work for which they were elected. Bangura tells me he did not break ranks with his party by taking the oath of office. He simply followed the constitution.
I did not break rank. I just followed the required constitutional clock that says every individual being elected as a member of parliament, that person needs to take the oath of office. That's what I did. I followed the constitution and I took the oath of office.
Well, your party disagrees with the results of the election. Where do you stand on that?
I do disagree too, especially the district where I came from, Tarine district. The SLPP from all the RRF form we have there, they got about 9,000. But the final results announcement was 90,000 it's called. So the question now one will ask, where did they get the 10,000 from? But in as much as I do disagree with the election results, there is a method in which we must follow. That is the court of law. Failing to go through the court of law, I wonder what options one have to seek.
So without your the rest of the members of parliament from the APC, are you performing any activities right now in parliament?
Oh, definitely. Tomorrow we have a sitting. I will be performing my activities as a member of parliament.
The fact that the main opposition is not sitting except for you, people say that's one-sided, that's one-party rule.
Well, I don't know about that, about one-party rule, but I am there to represent my people, and I'm going to do the best as possible to make sure that I take part into debates, I take part into scrutinizing the bills coming to us for the benefit of the people of this country.
I'm looking at it from the viewpoint of the rest of the MPs from the APC. They are not there. So whenever there's a vote, how would you vote?
I will vote based on the issue that we have. Let me tell you this. We are members of parliament. Our role is distinct from the executive. We are the legislator. We are there to make laws that the ruling government bring before us. We are to look the bills to make sure that the bills are in conformity with the aspiration of the people of this country. And as long as that bill comes before me and I have done all what I have to do in order for the bill to be good, I will vote in favor of the bill. I'm not voting in favor of the government. I'm voting in favor of the bill for the people of this country. And that's all I know.
Honorable Bangura, do you have any message for the other members of the APC who are not gone to parliament?
I will simply tell them that we have a job to do. We have been voted by the people of this country. We have to represent them well. Boycotting parliament, it's not the solution to the problems of this country. So I call upon them to go to the well of parliament, fulfill the constitutional mandate, and represent your people.
Honorable Mohamed Bangura is a member of parliament from the opposition All People's Congress Party. He was speaking with me from the Sierra Leone capital, Freetown. In Nigeria, civil and human rights defenders are calling for the immediate release of the suspended Central Bank of Nigeria governor, Godwin Emefiele. They said his continued detention by the Department of State Services, the DSS, is a violation of his fundamental rights. Their demand comes after the DSS charged the suspended governor with illegal possession of firearms. A high court recently asked for Emefiele's release, adding that his continued detention is the violation of his rights. Douglas Obankwa is a practicing Nigerian lawyer. He tells viewers Peter Clotty that the former bank governor must be treated fairly within the confines of the law.
I believe, quite frankly, the rule of law, and it's pursuant to that my belief that I feel that those that are calling for the release of Mr. Godwin Emefiele, the former governor of the Central Bank, their demands are not out of place. I want to just briefly give the legal trajectory. Emefiele was arrested a few weeks ago. While he was arrested, Emefiele had gone to court, and two courts gave two separate orders saying that one said he should be released forthwith, the other one said that he should be charged to court within 7 days. And in trying to situate the matter, if there is no order of court, as we speak, that is keeping Emefiele in prison, or in DSS detention, there will be no reason whatsoever for him to still be in their detention. Why some of us are not so happy with his antics, because while he was the governor of the central bank. That's what we tell Nigerian government officials. Try and build systems so that those systems will protect you when you leave office. You reckon that during his ill-fated Naira redesign project, the Supreme Court, which is the highest court in the land, gave an order that he should received immediately. Emefiele did not obey the order of the Supreme Court. You see, he is now being befallen by the same fates that he is thinking that because while he was in office, you think you can act with impunity.
Do Nigerians think his fundamental rights are being infringed upon by the DSS?
Absolutely, yes. If the order that was given for him to be detained expired on the 10th, his fundamental human rights has been infringed upon. Till now, even if the central bank said that they filed a formal charge, the filing of a charge does not constitute a remand order. If the court said it should be released, it should be released. It could be anyone. It's not about Emefiele. It's about a system that works, that can affect anybody, both the high and the mighty. So I believe, quite frankly, that his fundamental human rights are being infringed upon.
Well, the DSS says he's been detained after charging him with illegal firearms possession, that he's been detained for further investigations. So do you think the reasons given by the DSS for which they are still holding Godwin Emefiele is justified?
The point that I always tell, whether it's the DSS, the police, the EFCC, is that your reason is not the law. It is the law we look at in this perspective, and the law is very, very clear. The law is clear and unambiguous that except you have a court order keeping someone in your custody, if you kept that person without a court order, then you have infringed the person's fundamental human rights.
Douglas Obankwa is a practicing Nigerian lawyer. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty. A newspaper publisher in Cameroon's capital says he was told by three eyewitnesses of an attack by a gunman that killed 10 people. He says he was also told that the attackers were members of the Ambazonia Defense Forces, the main separatist group in the English-speaking region. The group has denied responsibility. Publisher Victor Nchambama tells me that the witnesses said the attackers referred to their victims as black legs. It is a phrase, he says, the separatists use to describe anyone who does not support the secession of an independent English-speaking Cameroon.
Yesterday, when I learned about the attack in Bamenda, immediately I called some three persons. In fact, who happened to be witnesses. One of them happens to be a junior in secondary school to me. And I had to ask actually what happened. And they told me at about the late hours of yesterday evening, young men stormed the area, Nacho Junction, in two vehicles, a Carina E and a RAF card. And when they stepped down, they accused everybody who was there of being a blackleg, whatever that means. And they started shooting indiscriminately. And that is how bullets shot people down, ended their lives for some, wounded some. Some took off. And that is what those three witnesses told me. And what really caught my attention was that, James, these people had the same version of what I was out to inquire or investigate.
Do the witnesses, do they have any idea about the shooters? What group do they belong to?
Yeah, without any emotions or sentiment, I will come out clearly to say that three of them told me they are those boys. I asked which boys. You know, out of fear in Bamenda, to speak just anyhow is a difficult thing, as I have heard. And when I asked them, you mean Amber boys? They said, yes, that they came and they said they are blacklegs. So by that very expression, it means that it could only be those boys. And since they were scared to voice it out clearly, and I asked again, they said yes. And three of them had the same answer. I saw fright in their voices. I felt something like the war was coming to an end.
Let me say that the Ambazonia Defense Forces, they denied that their group carried out the attack.
Yeah, that too is another version, because I don't think someone will want to claim responsibility for an act which the war is condemning and which has taken the war hostage. I mean, everybody is virtually in pain.
When you say that the shooters said something like black leg, what is that?
Black leg.
What is that? What is blacklist?
Blacklist means someone who doesn't go by the ideology, someone who is against the ideology, someone who, you know, according to them, doesn't want them to achieve independence, whatever that means.
Victor Mchambama is the publisher of the Municipal Updates, a daily newspaper in Cameroon. He was speaking with me from Yaoundé. And that's it for this Tuesday, July 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a